cast your line for big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIV. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. Two- to three-person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
This is WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment, located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com. Riff Rock. Rocks. Take to the ice with 101 WRAF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a three-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRAF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRAF. Rip Rocks. A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on a 2005 Harley-Davidson Fatboy. The 6th annual MDA Black and Blue Ball. May 6th at the Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn. Call for tickets at 586-274-9000. From Ford Motor Company, Motor City Harley-Davidson, Pepsi Bottling Group, and 101 WRIF. Riff Rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Yeah, that's right. It's a little bad, 11 o'clock, 11:05 in Detroit. We're broadcasting on 101 FM WRIF in Detroit and by the internet, WRIF.com and radiopower.org, all across the country, all across the world. So, welcome, whether you are listening in Detroit or Southfield or Southgate or South Lyon in our listening area or anywhere in the world. Hello to people in Sweden, in Finland, in Australia, in Mexico, in Brazil, in Singapore, in South Korea. We know all of you are listening. Welcome. Yeah, it's your chance, at least locally. A lot of people don't like to spend the dime. This is supposed to be a local show, but it's taken on a national and international expression. But so we just have our local number. So about 99% of the callers we get are our WRIF listeners. And, yeah, hey, that's fine. So 313-298-WRIF. If you just tuned in for the first time, the show's been around for decades, so I always assume everyone knows what it's all about. We talk about the issues of the day. I give my opinion, you give your opinion. That's what this whole show is set up for. And it goes till 1 a.m. Eastern Time, and then from 1 to 2, I broadcast interviews that I've done previously, and I go home. I listen to them on the way home. If you're far away and don't want to spend the dime to call 313-298-WRIF, I can understand that. You can write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And short messages usually have a possibility of getting read. If they're very long, I can't edit them as I go along. So your best making them short, unless you got a lot to say and maybe I'll read them tomorrow. Anyway, my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R. My last name is W-E-R-B-E. So that's P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. And also we have a chat room. You can go to tomhartman.com and get on the chat room there. And some people are already starting to ring in. Very soon, our producer, Jay Hudson, who just got done co-hosting and producing Motor City Riffs, will be there to get your call, so patience, please. And a very happy May Day to you. That's right, May 1st. Oh, here in Detroit, we've got about 54 minutes left of that. A very important worldwide holiday in two regards. One, it's been an international workers' holiday. That's about 90% of us. Since the 1880s, that's when May 1st, 1886, was declared the day at which the eight-hour day would come into being. Now, that was called by the labor unions. The bosses, the employers, the plutocracy, the rulers, the rich rulers, they said, you're working 10 hours a day. Well, if you're a kid, you work 10. If you're a grown-up, you might even work 12 hours a day. So the employers responded how they frequently do when working people ever want anything different. They called out the troops. They called out the cops. They shot workers down in the street. They accused them of crimes they didn't do. They executed them. And it's to these valiant workers, the center of a lot of the agitation for it, a lot of the violence initiated by the Chicago police, the victims of state judicial murder took place in Chicago. And finally, it was an eight-hour day. That's so it's been 8 hours since then. And there's sort of, people say, isn't there, there was some old song from the 40s, let me see, I work 8 hours and I rest 8 hours and I sleep 8 hours a day. That seemed just fine. Kind of split up this trimester of the day, eight and eight and eight. It seemed to work. But as wealth accumulated, we could have done two things. Either more wealth could have gone to the wealthy people, or they could have done things like reduce the work day. So we'd work 6 hours a day instead of having three shifts, for instance. There'd be four shifts. That way you'd have everyone employed. People would have more of their life. I mean, some of us like our jobs. I like mine. I don't complain when I have to go to work. But I know a lot of you do jobs. And I don't mean just jobs in factories or stuff like that, but offices as well. I mean, I'd like to be there as little as possible, and if you're like any of my friends, you probably feel the same way. So as the wealth of the country, as the accumulation of wealth continued to pace, there was two options. One, the wealthy could take more money and become even wealthier, or two, reduce the number of hours. But that is the dirty word to the people that employ, and that is a distribution of wealth that everyone gets, everyone is able to take advantage of. I don't like that. Anyway, so it's a workers' holiday, and it was way beyond, which became by probably the 50s, just a parade of communist police state show of their armed might. Somewhere along the line, maybe someone can remind me, either at 313-298-WRIF or calltalkyes@yahoo.com, This government decided to have our Labor Day in September. And this was in contradiction to what was going on all across the world. I think this even happened before communism and all that. So it was mainly to stop international worker solidarity. Because, you know, workers, when they get together, sometimes they really change things. Like they get an eight-hour day. We get an eight-hour day instead of the 10- or 12-hour day. Or we form unions. So they, you know, the idea here of the employers in this country, the wealthy in this country, was to keep workers as split up as possible. It's also a pagan holiday. Many, particularly countries in Europe, May 1st, named after what is goddess Maya? Maya? M-A-I? What is Maya? M-A-I-A? Isn't it something like that? But anyways, it's Beltane among the pagans, and it's the spring ritual of fertility and rebirth and spring and what have you. And it's a holiday, you know, directly keyed into the passing of the seasons that we can touch and feel and that we're deeply connected with. And the early spiritual experiences of people did that. They were directly connected in. I mean, this was before sky gods came along. And you know, left the people that you know, we had to beseech them and depend on them for salvation and what have you. So paganism directly connects the human with the human experience and with the experience of other species that we share the planet with, both animal and plant, of course. Now, here there we have this new pope. We don't hold it, right? We're not supposed to hold it against him that he was in Hitler youth, and just because he's been very conservative ever since, we still don't hold it against him. I mean, couldn't they have found someone else that wasn't called God's Rottweiler or something like that? Or, I mean, couldn't they have found another pope that hadn't been in the Hitler youth? Anyways, in Vatican City, the normal rhythms of the Vatican began returning Wednesday as Pope Benedict XVI held a traditional weekly papal audience, using the moment to express what may become a central theme of his papacy, or papacy, whatever you like. The Christian roots of Europe. So that's what he wants to emphasize, the Christian roots of Europe. I mean, that's fine. I mean, you know. Doesn't sound too much like the Middle Ages, does it? Addressing thousands of pilgrims on a brilliant morning in St. Peter's Square, he explained that he had chosen the name Benedict for several reasons, among them the role that St. Benedict of Norcia, in Italy, the 6th century author of the monastic rule that led to the founding of the Benedictine order, had on spreading Christianity in Europe. He was one of the patron saints of Europe. The Pope said in Italian, Benedict represents a fundamental point of reference for the unity of Europe and a strong reminder of the unrenounceable Christian roots of its culture and civilization. True or false? Well, as far as I've ever been able to read, I'm not religious, so maybe I've missed a few things, and some of you may know a little bit more about it than I do. I didn't think Christianity was a European religion at all. I thought it was a Middle Eastern religion that essentially had established itself through the sword, that it had destroyed all the other religions in its path, taking the first commandment, that thou shalt have no other gods before me, and destroyed paganism, the fundamental religion of Europe, much like the religions all throughout the rest of the world, in Africa, Asia, the Americas, before Christianity came with its bloody sword to demand that it have, you know, the people have no other god before it. So, essentially, our roots, those of us who are European, of European ancestry like me, our roots aren't Christian at all, but they're pagan. And if you're from Latin America, or Asia, or Africa, same thing. Religions and spiritual practices that connected us up palpably, in the sense that you could feel with the other species, with the passing of the stations of our lives. All right, okay. That's what I think. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. What else? Oh, yeah. You know, I for some reason or other, I can't get out of my mind this woman that chided me because I'm going to forget it again. Oh, yeah, that because I couldn't correctly remember the name of Lacey Peterson. I almost couldn't remember her name. Lacey Peterson's husband, Scott. And she said this was one of the two most important, the second most important story of 2004. I never did get from her what the first one was. I'm afraid to ask. So here you go again. There's this woman in Florida, the runaway bride in Georgia, that was missing, and then it turned out she just got cold feet and fled. This led all during the weekend. Fortunately, there's other stories up there now. But this is what I mean. This is, I was going to say bread and circuses for the masses, except we only get circuses. We don't get the bread. I mean, one of the way the Roman rulers continued to rule was to give bread. But what these rulers do is take away bread from a lot of us. And if you don't think you're having bread taken away from you, just wait with me for a minute or so. Anyways, so I don't know the name of the runaway bride. This listener may think I'm remiss. But here's what I was looking at. 10 U.S. soldiers killed in the last 48 hours in Iraq, or what I would call Bush's illegal and unnecessary war. Bush's unnecessary and illegal war. 10 more U.S. soldiers have been killed in the last 48 hours. I try to keep this count up on my website, peterwerby.com. And every once in a while, this word, instrumentalism, it means using. I mean, just what it says, using something for other purposes. And every once in a while, I mean, I realize that I'm placing the number of the dead to kind of put it in the face of these war supporters. Here is what you support, the continuing death of American soldiers for this illegal and unnecessary war based on Bush's lies about weapons of mass destruction. And all of a sudden, I get this terrible shudder, and I realize these aren't numbers. These are human beings. These are our neighbors and our children and our relatives and our community members that never should have left the United States on Bush's fool's errand. Of course, you know, he made sure he never went to Vietnam like all the rest of the chicken hawks in the Republican administration. And these same relatives and friends and sons and daughters of ours are in Iraq killing people as well. And this country is just being, you know, progressively destroyed. Well, so happy May Day to you on that note. And that's the basis that I would celebrate it on. 313-298-WRIF. CallTalkYes@yahoo.com. Oh, yeah. Let's see. Eric's living in Tucson, Detroit native, and he writes into CallTalkYes@yahoo.com to say that still my voice is very loud and the callers are barely audible. So, please, if you will, our engineers here at WRIF have been working on that. I'm going to pay real close attention to the levels that I have here. So, wait a while, and then when I start getting callers, and actually there's a lot of you waiting on the line already, write in if you're listening on the Internet and let me know how it all sounds. All right. Richest country in the world, right? The best country in the world, U.S. number one. And all we hear is a diminution of our standards of living. In other words, it's a race to the bottom. We're going down. And maybe you're doing better. You know what? I'm doing better. You know what? I am doing better. So it can't be just anecdotal. You know what I'm saying? You just can't be saying, well, I'm doing better. Everything's great. I mean, we have to look at the totality. What's happening and what's in our future? And it's all about cuts. It's about cuts. It's about cuts. It's about cuts. Now, Bush got on television the other night, and he's got this plan that would cut Social Security benefits. Now, why in the world, in the richest country in the world that knows how to manage its money? See, rich kids, ultra-wealthy people, which the Bush administration serves and is also comprised of, they don't know anything about that. They screw up in their businesses. Doesn't hurt them. You know, you and I screw up. Man, we're gone. We're out of there. We're down the drain. We lose our house or something like that. Can't even declare bankruptcy anymore because Bush did the bidding of the credit card companies who contributed so handsomely to his campaign and put in this bankruptcy bill, which is even harder. Now, you know this deal that they say that we're going bankrupt. He keeps saying we're going bankrupt. Well, it's just BS. Almost said it. Now, according to the Social Security trustees, the system has more than enough money to pay full benefits till 2041. We got, we're owed trillions of dollars by the federal government. They say, we can't count on that. It's bad debt. What the hell? The United States government isn't going to pay off its debts. It's going to pay off its debts. So there's absolutely, if we don't do a single thing to, for the next 35 years, doesn't that make it, or something like that? 36 years. For the next 36 years, there's just enough money in the Social Security system. So there's no crisis. There's no problem whatsoever. Then the system would still be capable of paying about three-quarters of the promised benefits of today. As it is, Bush is talking about reducing these benefits. So you would think it would still be all right on. But, you know, it should be fixed. Because not only should we make the system completely solvent, and there's been other times along the way since it began in the 1930s, that we had to adjust income into the system to provide for people that have paid in all along. So this generation, like you and me, are paying for our parents or our grandparents, and the people behind us will do the same thing. That's the way the system is set up. It's not a savings account. It's not an investment account. It's set up, the most successful government program to take care of us. Bush is lying. Bush is creating a crisis, just a phony crisis, just like he did with Iraq, and just like there were no weapons of mass destruction, there's no crisis with Social Security. It's that easy. So let's see. Where in here did he say? Under the proposal, benefit cuts would be imposed gradually on future retirees. This is what you have to look forward to. You're working your butts off right now. Some of you are working lots of jobs. These cuts would fall most heavily on the people at upper income levels. So it's sort of a means test. In other words, if you're making, you know, you're 75, you're making $300,000 a year, maybe you shouldn't be getting the full $1,400, $1,500 a month that you're eligible for. That's okay. That's okay. You're right. But the cuts would be less, but still substantial for middle-income workers. The cuts that Bush is proposing, this man of wealth, never did a damn day's work in his life that meant anything, is proposing to cut the income, the retirement income, the benefits for substantially for middle-income workers. He says low-income workers would suffer no benefits cuts at all. But what they're, I mean, they want to destroy Social Security. They want to get rid of it completely. They want to turn it over to all their buddies on Wall Street that would take billions of dollars of fees out. I mean, this is what it's all about. So there's got to be other solutions to get the money. And this isn't one of them. So we could do one thing. We could raise taxes on you and me. That sucks. None of us want that. We could raise it on the rich people. That's all right with me because, you know, they got enough money and they've already gotten a bunch of cuts to begin with. But one of the things, the easy thing, this would solve it all, just like you and I pay full payroll taxes. So if we're making $30,000 a year, $50,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year, every penny we make is taxed as a payroll tax. But when you get to $90,000, there's an arbitrary ceiling. You don't have to pay anymore. That's it. So if you make $17 million a year, you only have to pay on $90,000. Well, how about this? Why don't we let the people that can most afford it pay the bulk of it? And then we'll all be secure and there won't be all this. Now, in this article, but it's cuts, 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 cuts. And this is what I mean. The wealthiest country in the world, there's an assault on our standard of living. And even if maybe you individually aren't suffering this, this is happening in the aggregate to the overall population. In this article, which is, in a way, too intricate to really explain, health coverage dispute pits older retirees against younger. It's all here. I mean, we're fighting for the crumbs. This is what happens on the race to the bottom. And Let's see, where is this one little paragraph in here? Unfortunately for both sides, the issue arises at a time when climbing health costs have meant that only about 1 in 7 private employers still cover retirees of any age. I mean, it's horrible. Front page of the Detroit News on Wednesday, April 27th. Suppliers cut retiree health care. So firms like the Metaldyne Corporation just said, well, here's a little letter that retirees got. Metaldyne will be discontinuing post-retirement medical and life benefits. Screw you! You just worked 35 years in this man, I got such a foul mouth when it comes to this, because I'm just so angry of what's happening to other people. And it's also, I mean, I usually don't think I function out of guilt. Maybe just because I'm in a fortunate point where circumstances in my life are actually improving, the idea that someone has worked in the supplier shop for 35 years and suddenly this corporation writes him and says, Metaldyne will be discontinuing post-retirement medical and life benefits. Screw you. Well, they don't put that, but that's what they're saying. What the hell do you do? What is happening in this country? This as well, this item as well here. It's going to be a protest and rally on Friday, May 6th at 1 p.m. At the Charter One Bank Building in downtown Detroit. On March 31st, janitors at 1001 Woodward in Detroit were told it was their last day of work. Some of them had worked 18 to 35 years as janitors cleaning the building, but Sky Management replaced them with janitors making a fraction of the pay and none of the benefits because they were in a union. So these were people, lawyers go on strike, nothing much happens bad. Janitors go on strike, things are pretty nasty. So these were part of Local 3, and they just got S-canned. So why? Oh, well, why pay people union wages when we can pay them lousy wages, huh? Congress has passed a budget that cuts Medicaid. Of course, screw the poor, right? This is mainly going to help poor, and we know that people that are poor have done it all to themselves. Of course, millions of these people on Medicaid are poor children and poor elderly. We don't care about that. Here's this another great Bush deal. Medicare change will limit access to claim hearing. So, this is Medicare. This is what's available to all of us as we retire. And there's different times. There's you don't agree. They say, I'm sorry, we're not accepting your claim. And that's the job of the administrators. But what's happened before is that there was 140 Social Security offices around the country. And what you could do, you could go to any of them and you could appeal in person. Now, you're 82 years old. A lot of people, there's a mischaracterization and a stereotype of older people as being infirm and frightened and confused and what have you. That's not as true as it used to be. But it is true of many seniors. Many seniors are all by themselves, particularly women. Some of them have depended on men all their lives. Some of them are very timid. But at least they could go into a helpful Social Security office and say, you denied my claim. I'd like to appeal. I want to talk to a hearing officer. George W. Bush has instituted a new federal policy that will make it significantly more difficult for Medicare beneficiaries to obtain hearings in person. And when the government denies their claims for home care, nursing home services, prescription drugs and other treatments. They're going to take these 140 Social Security offices, blow them off, and replace them with 130, 110, 90, 80, 60, 40, 30, I won't go on, four. Four appeal centers for our seniors. Another big message from the rulers of this society, screw you. You're scrap. You're old. You don't labor any longer. You don't get health benefits. You don't get retirement benefits. I mean, isn't this just enough to send you over the edge? Knowing that this is happening, and this could be, easily be you and me. Just because I said things are getting a little better for me. Hey, this is, we live in the country where it's the wheel of misfortune. You're doing great one day. Poof, yeah, you're gone. Molly Ivins, I-V-I-N-S. Just maybe Google her, and most amazing stuff will pop up. She's a, columnist and author. And remember I mentioned before this old word from 100 years ago, plutocracy. That's the rule of the rich, plutocracy. She says our new Pluto theocracy, of course, because of these wealthy, selfish, mean-spirited people that now rule and actually get some support from ordinary people, which I can't understand for the life of me. Let me just read some of the statistics. The Economic Policy Institute reports the economic well-being of middle-class families has declined between 2000 and 2003. Three reasons: bad economy, Bush tax policies, and the cost of health care. The Tax Justice Network recently reports the world's richest individuals have placed $11.5 trillion in assets in offshore tax havens to avoid paying taxes, some 10 times the GDP of Great Britain. So it means that if they paid their fair share of taxes, a lot of these problems, maybe all of them, would be gone. The ratio of CEO pay to average worker pay reached 300-1 in 2003. The average worker takes home $517 a week. That's us. The average worker, $517 a week, which means, this is the United States, that after take-home pay, the average person in this country, the wealthiest country in the world, takes home $25,000 a year. While this average CEO earned $155,000 a week. And this, now it's 300-1, the ratio between CEO and worker. The ratio in 82 was 42-1. Get this. I mean, this is why, you know, that the rage comes out. Here's a dialogue between President Bush and a citizen during a February meeting in Nebraska where Bush was trying to sell his scheme to privatize Social Security. Woman in the audience, that's good because I work three jobs. I feel like I contribute. Bush, you work three jobs? Woman. Three jobs, yes. Bush, uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that's fantastic what you're doing. Applause. Get any sleep? One out of every two jobs created in the United States over the last 12 months was taken by a worker over 55. Economist Dean Baker says the flood of older workers is caused by the falling value of retirees' 401ks and the cost of health care. So our seniors have to go back to work. The number of long-term unemployed who are college graduates has nearly tripled since 2000. Nearly one in five of the long-term jobless are college graduates, according to the Los Angeles Times. So, and I know a lot of you say, yeah, God, man, I don't want to pay any more taxes. Well, I don't think you should. Remember, under my system, there's a $50,000 deductible right off the top. And it starts getting paid back over on the top end. So the multimillionaires and the billionaires pick up the slack as they should. Now, where's our, we pay, this is just per person, about $6,500. The average household pays, $6,500. $2,000 of it goes to military and war. $573. Think about this is when you worked. I mean, you worked. You made $25,000 take home on the average, and $2,000 of what you paid in taxes went to the military. That's the Halliburton and the the Carlyle Group and, you know, people that have a vested interest in war and destruction. Interest on the military debt, $573. This is what you and I paid as well. Interest on the debt, non-military, $635. Because we got so many veterans, $223. So it's on and on like that. We're getting screwed, folks. We're getting screwed at the gas pump. We're getting screwed on taxes. We're getting screwed on services. And why? Why? Tell me. And why do you still have a Bush sticker on your truck? How dumb are you?
This is WRIF.com. If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391. Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Listening WRIF.com.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
Rip, rip, rock, rock.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like the Shark Club on Ford Road, just east of Canton Center Road in Canton. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Double rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff rock.
Like what you hear on the riff? Then why not get your riff rock to go? Download all your favorite riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff rock. Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. Man, I did a lot of talking. Now it's your turn. 313-298-WRIF. I welcome people to the show saying Happy May Day, both International Workers Holiday, and let me see if I can get this up real quickly. But I guess as long ago, according to Debbie in Boston, talking about American Labor Day, traced back to the Knights of Labor in the United States, parades organized in 1882. But fearing May Day might strengthen the U.S. socialist movement, President Grover Cleveland quickly moved in 1887 to support the position of the Knights of Labor and place the date for Labor Day in September, to keep it away from like I said, that international deal. So also, Bush, cuts. Medicaid for the poor, Medicare centers. What do you think about that? Reducing for our elderly, which hopefully one day will be us, but right now are our parents and our grandparents, reducing the appeal centers from 140 to 4. So they want to deflect people from actually appealing negative rulings on their claims. And we'll talk a little about gas prices. Old Rush Limbaugh and more bad news legally. And this dude may be going down. Remember, he's the guy that advocated jail terms for drug abusers. We'll see about that. Let's take our first call late into the program. Here's Doug from Ann Arbor. Doug, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How you doing?
Doing great.
Hi, I think that I know why. I've listened to your show like maybe a few times. I think a lot of people in general don't receive your message wholeheartedly, I mean a majority of Americans, because it's mixed up with some kind of extreme elements.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, for example, I went to your website and you have this Bush-Hitler imagery. I mean, well, most, you know, four or five people, you know, that I know may agree with that, but most of America doesn't really agree with that.
So? So why?
Well, I mean...
You mean you're giving me advice. You think maybe if I was a little more moderate in some of the imagery on my website, I'd be more effective.
That's correct.
Well, thank you. I always appreciate it.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate that. I will consider that.
I'm a gay man and a gay journalist.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a major newspaper in Detroit. And I run across a lot of opinions all the time. And, this is just the general consensus when I hear people talking about your show. Well, you know, he's too extreme, you know. You know, it's mixed in. Nobody wants to associate, you know, anybody with Hitler unless it really is Hitler, you know.
Well, I have to say that the imagery, if you go to my website at peterwerby.com and go to the Bush pages, that there is some of that imagery that I've, you know, I just copy and paste. And it's an extreme statement of displeasure and a comparison. I mean, there's been these things on the web about the 17 points of fascism and how they compare to what's going on today. So it's not exactly empty. I mean, I don't think George Bush is going to start rounding up Jews or start World War III. Well, anyways, I mean, I appreciate the... What do you think about this, though? Here, a Spanish cardinal compared gay marriage to Nazism.
Well, they have a lot of extreme views in the right wing of the Catholic Church, and I don't think, again, that represents the mainstream either.
You don't? I wonder, with the new pope, whether it does or it doesn't.
No, I don't think most people in America or Europe Catholic, you know, that I know. You know, as a gay man and a gay journalist working for a newspaper in Detroit.
Major newspaper in Detroit.
I don't think that they really represent the majority.
Well,
but I think, sorry to cut you off, but I think that every time there's movements in to want to pull the church in one direction, there's always kind of a reaction. A visceral reaction, say, in some of the older bishops and cardinals to want to pull the church back, and they want to put up somebody to represent the core foundation beliefs, and that just so happens to be someone that has all these, say, right-wing views. But
and is now the pope, and that was assured that there'd be this right-wing pope, because the last pope installed the 95% of archbishops who would, in fact, vote this extraordinarily conservative and right-wing man who represents the right wing of the church. I mean, this is an institution that of which there was a struggle, and the far right wing of the church has won overwhelmingly. And I don't know how, anyway, they're going to change it, because now when Benedict the 16th appoints people, it's going to be the same. He's going to appoint other people who are God's Rottweilers.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that change has to be slow and moderate, and it has to be very moderate voices and reasonable voices, you know. Like, people who have brought about, you know, radical change, such as Martin Luther King, they weren't, say, radical people, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, the Southerners sure thought so.
Well, looking back on it now, it was compared to the Black Panthers or, you know, the violent...
Yeah, all of a sudden when the Black Panthers came along, suddenly people said, oh, well, maybe Martin Luther King Jr. and his nonviolence and his reform program isn't so bad. But then when Martin Luther King Jr. started condemning the war in Vietnam, when Martin Luther King Jr. started taking the side of oppressed workers, suddenly he wasn't so popular, and some people even think that's why he was assassinated.
Well, that may be true. May or may not be true, but...
Well, anyways, I appreciate your counsel for moderation. It's nothing I'm really feel necessity to do. And if people don't like my extreme message, they should utter their own or go to websites that are a little more moderate. Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it very much. By the way, I saw this... he said it was a gay man, a gay journalist. And I saw this article in USA Today with this woman, Elaine Donnelly, said there's good reasons to exclude gays from the military. She says that they should respect the normal human desire for sexual modesty. I don't know what planet this woman is living on, but I don't think there's too much modesty anymore. She says servicemen and women should not have to expose themselves to persons who might be sexually attracted to them. It would be unfair to force the homosexual agenda on young people whose lives are difficult enough. What about the heterosexual agenda? I mean, isn't there a little bit, I mean, forget about gays. Servicemen and women should not have to expose themselves to persons who might be sexually attracted to them. Well, I don't think in terms of that kind of activity that it's has anything to do with, you know, gay or straight sex. I mean, you got young people there, right? But what's happening with remarks like this cardinal who compared gay marriage to Nazism? What happens to this little local fascist Elaine Donnelly? Harassment and violence against gays rose again in 2004. This is from a gay magazine. I think this is Gay Magazine. The New Standard said 26% spike in violence against the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. And this is all comes about because of the manner in which these opportunistic right-wing politicians have mobilized for their own reasons, nothing to do with gay marriage or anything like that, this dislike for gay people. So maybe it gets them elected. Maybe it gets these shameful amendments passed to our Constitution barring gay marriage. But also it does, it gives social permission to those people that are the sickos, permission to commit violence and discrimination against gay people. It's really, really bad. All right, some open lines. I really am going to let you talk, so get on the phone. People are getting on. They go, is this guy ever going to shut up? Sometimes I don't. 313-298-WRIF, and here's Joe. Joe has been waiting a long time. He's in Lincoln Park. Thanks, Joe, for waiting, and you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm hanging in there.
Good. Go ahead. What's up?
I don't know if you heard, but our president, George Wacko, or wrongdoer, or weasel if you prefer, Bush, proposed building some new terrorist attack points here in America.
What's that?
Oh, he proposed building some new nuclear power plants.
Right.
And he made no absolutely no mention of conservation or renewable resources or anything. He just said, let's build some nuclear reactors to boil some water and get power from this.
Yeah, right. Rather than, I mean, see, this again is all about money. It's not about energy. And if you look at the Bush energy bill, remember that was the one where Cheney was in this room and Ken Lay, remember him? That's what sparked Iraq. But Ken Lay was holding Cheney's hand and with his crayon and writing the energy bill that would benefit all the big energy companies and the polluters.
Yep.
And nuclear power is part of it. Now, there's real easy ways to solve this. I mean, we could do things like get off of incandescent bulbs and go to all fluorescent. I've got increasingly those fluorescent bulbs in my house just because I don't want to keep changing a lot of them because some of them are, you know, up in fixtures. And that would almost save enough to get us out of the mess we could. But energy-efficient cars, energy conservation in general, and then a crash program to get off of oil would solve all this. Instead, Bush wants to have the American taxpayer get ripped off to subsidize the most dangerous and low-efficiency energy production system imaginable, yeah, nuclear power.
That's what they mentioned, too. They want the taxpayers to fund it because it's not profitable. Now, I might go for the new nuclear power plants if we can store the waste in one of Bush's barns in Crawford, Texas. I might go for it then. Thanks for letting me vent my anger, Pete.
Oh, sure. Thanks thanks for joining us. Actually, did you hear that? I just crunched a cough drop. Wow. Now I got it in my mouth. Terrible. Terrible unprofessional programming. But better than coughing, huh? This damn cold has never left me 100%. Yeah, I mean, Bush and his cronies, I mean, they look and they say, what's the opposition? Little. So, what the hell? They'll go right ahead. Somewhere or other, I have nukes here. Maybe we can do, though. We'll do that when we come back. Page 2. Where is all this? All right. But anyways, that's essentially what's going on. They've got this energy bill that would... maybe it's in. You know, I try to be a little more organized, and it still doesn't work. Now, this is gasoline, but I mean that's part of it all too. I like the way this is. This article begins from USA Today. Drivers can complain about the soaring cost of oil, gasoline. You and I, so we're complaining. Hell, we don't like this. We're paying. $2.29 at the pump. I guess it's down a little. It's down to $2.19. Wow, isn't that great? But get this. But investors should think twice before they carp about how it has hurt them, because it hasn't. Surging energy company earnings, fueled by a 26% rise in the price of oil this year, has exerted a powerful and positive influence on first quarter earnings, as well as the stock market itself. So, you know, a lot of these, I don't understand, there's a lot of these working and middle-class guys, they angrily call me and they say, you know, you want a redistribution of income, you're a socialist. This is a redistribution of income. Instead of it going from the people that can afford it to the people that need it, the middle class and the working class and the poor, it's the other way around. We are giving more and more of our hard-earned money to the people that already have more than they even know what to do about. So that's what's happening. The reason that these companies are making so much money is because we're paying more. And they say, oh, well, it's just, they're passing along the cost. Well, here's what someone I've interviewed a number of times, Tyson Slocum, from he's a research director for Public Citizen. They have something called Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program. Since Bush took office, says Slocum, the largest five oil companies operating in the U.S. have after-tax profits of $205 billion. We need to examine the relationship between the U.S. oil company profits and the higher prices for consumers and American industry. For example, in 2004, ExxonMobil chalked up the world's biggest ever profit for a single company, $25.3 billion. Is it possible, he asks, that ExxonMobil and other U.S. oil companies are making part of their profits off price gouging? Do you think? This is just amazing. He says it's like Enron. Indeed it is. Bob Williams, director of the Politics of Oil Project at the Center for Public Integrity, said, we found that the oil industry here in the U.S. spends more than $440 million on candidates, political parties, and lobbyists to carry its water in Washington, D.C. Essentially what that means is that they're investing $440 million to get back $25 billion. And the transfer of wealth happens because we pay more and more at the gas pump while the investors reap the profits. So this is a transfer of wealth upward. This is a redistribution of income. And why is it that people that are getting gouged, these angry middle-class guys that usually email me only, they're saying, you want to take money from, like that. Well, they are taking our money. This is how they get ultra wealthy. This is why the average American worker takes home only $25,000 a year after taxes, and why these guys reap profits of billions. Here's a guy that would say it's perfectly all right, it's good for us. The Florida Supreme Court said Thursday it will not consider an appeal from conservative commentator Rush Limbaugh over the prosecutor's seizure of his medical records during an investigation into whether he illegally purchased painkillers. Remember, he was in the parking lot copping drugs and whatever. I guess he sent his housemate. They seized Limbaugh's medical records in 2003 for an investigation into whether he illegally purchased prescription painkillers and illegally visited multiple doctors to receive duplicate prescriptions. Now, his lawyer is saying, if anybody with back pain can understand this. Well, I know a lot of people with back pain. And they have not copped 2,000 painkillers in 6 months and took them all. I mean, how the hell did he do his show? You remember, I've said this a lot, you know, war on drugs. I can't even drive on drugs. I mean, how the hell I could do it? I mean, it would be impossible for me to do a show, but he did. So he was gobbling Oxycontin at this incredible rate. Well, yeah, Limbaugh acknowledges addiction to pain medication in October 2003, blaming it. Remember, he's always the one that's talking about, you know, no victimization. Blaming it on severe back pain and took a 5-week leave from his radio show to enter rehab. He's playing golf. He was at golf outings. While he was, you know, in such severe back pain. All right, here's a little song from Rush Limbaugh on WRIF, The Night Call Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rush Limbaugh.
They say that I'm sleaze and elitist. You please, everybody disagrees with my rap. I'm horrendous, I'm appalling. My ratings now are falling because I'm so full of bull, so full of crap. Condescending crimes, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud, can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic, tuss.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am.
Because I'm a Nazi. That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class, because I'm a fat conservative butthead with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative butthead.
Hey.
With the face of a horse's ass.
I have a subhuman figure, a huge rear end. My brain? That's another story.
It's quite another story.
I have a face the size of a washtub. And my ass is as big as Missouri. Yes!
This bastard is sick. He's a fat mob is big and his ass is as big as Missouri.
Yes, Curry Bob! Manipulating statements exaggerate the truth. I can't believe they hate my show. It's bias. It's not just because I'm stupid. It's not just because I'm scum. It's just because Republicans are liars. I am heartless. I am vain, insensitive, insane. They say that I'm a national disgrace. I am nasty, insulting, basically revolting. I'm a concentrated pile of human waste. Because I'm a Nazi.
Heil!
I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
That's right. You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle classes. I'm a sick Republican sneezeball with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a sick Republican sneezeball.
How?
With the face of a horse's ass.
They say that this is not about my vanity. They doubt my sanity. They think I'm nuts.
So nuts.
I am a cyst on the ass of humanity. New Republican slogan, read my guts. From the bowels of the age comes the voice of Rush Limbaugh. In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the capo, the capo, Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo. The right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob. The democratic trashing, years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a grommet. With the IQ of a fig, I'm a fat, obnoxious pig. And the truth of the matter is, I'm vomit. Because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class, because I'm a fear-mongering scumbag with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative
butthead.
Hey,
sick Republican sleazeball. Fear-mongering scumbag.
Oh.
Egotistical ass bite.
Mean-spirited,
hog-wallering fat conservative toss.
With the face of a horse's ass.
Megan, do
that's extreme enough for our friend from Ann Arbor. This is Peter Werby. We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of 4 tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the 4 tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today, or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Listening WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rock.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
The Riff rocks the road. Every week, check out WRIF.com for information on upcoming Riff events. Sponsored by Wireless Toys, announcing no more activation fees. Get reimbursed for the activation fee on any new service, any new provider.
Riff rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to the second half of our broadcast. Jay Hudson, our producer, and where's our next caller, Jay?
Let's go to Hayes right here, caller three.
Caller three, all right, thank you. We're doing it the old-fashioned way then. Anyways, we've been around the block about six times since in the last hour, wishing you a happy May Day as the International Workers' Holiday and also the pagan holiday of Beltane, the renewal, the holiday of renewal of spring of fertility, and also talking about how we're being robbed at every level, that our standard of living as a society is being hit. Bush talking about cuts in our Social Security, cuts in our Medicare, cuts in our Medicaid, more and more companies taking away. I mean, you don't have anything to say about it. It's not like you can vote for Congress, but retirees just having their medical benefits just gone. All right, let's see. Let's go to Hayes here. Hayes, hi, it's Peter Werby. Where are you calling from?
Hi, Peter. I'm calling from Ann Arbor.
Welcome.
Welcome to you. And I just wanted to tell you, don't you dare modify yourself.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
how dare he?
Well, I mean, we're talking, we should say that earlier someone else called in from Ann Arbor and said that my website, peterwerby.com, was too extreme, and often I said too extreme things. Well,
I heard that.
Yeah.
And it was ridiculous. Listen, this is not the time to be shy and worried about what people are, whether their feelings are hurt. For crying out loud, the power of the Republicans on all fronts is frightening. And if we cannot speak out, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm. Even
there are no checks and balances anymore.
No, there isn't. And even, I'm sorry, go ahead.
There's a deserted effort on all fronts for the Republicans to take over every aspect of government,
mm-hmm.
and television and radio, and they're using the churches. And I just, you know, when will the religious people wake up and realize they're just being manipulated for political reasons?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, of course, I know enough religious people that wouldn't identify with what's being posed as Christianity these days.
Exactly. Well, it's I just, please don't pay attention to people like him.
No, well, here's what I think. I think that a lot of my views are, and I'm going to be very precise about this word, Hayes, radical. Radical means two things. It means, one, the least known one, it means going to the root of a problem or of a concept or what have you. So you have the most precise, and that's, I mean, yeah, I know that sounds kind of arrogant to say I'm doing it, but that's what I try to do. Radical also means extreme. I think this nation is in extreme danger on many, many fronts, politically, culturally, many of the things you are very articulately put forth there, environmentally. And in that sense, I speak in a very radical voice. If people don't like it, say what I said to this guy. Let them go to a moderate site. Let them speak moderately themselves. What the hell do they care what I do? I mean, if he was just genuine and saying, I'm not being effective because I'm being too extreme or too radical or too militant or whatever, well, I appreciate that, but we each speak in our own voice, eh?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, we're really dealing with a bunch of bullies and cowards, and that's really what you have to look at. If you don't speak up against the bullies and the cowards, then you might as well just hand it to them.
Thank you, Hayes.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
Bye now. And now to Lake Orion and Big Brady. Big Brady, hi, you're on the air. Big Brady, maybe I didn't do this. Let me see. Yeah, I did. How come? Well, I'm going to, let me see if I know how to do that. I'm going to put him back on hold, and I will then just go to Pat in Ferndale. Hi, Pat, you're on the air. Good evening. Now, there's something going on wrong here. Let me see.
Hello.
Oh, hey, Pat.
Oh, sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, just be real careful with disposing of your fluorescent bulbs. They contain mercury. And
Wait. You kind of got a little, must be on a cell phone. You got a little blip there. What has mercury in them?
Fluorescent bulbs. All fluorescent bulbs have, now they have greener bulbs that are green at the end,
mm-hmm.
that have less mercury. But the idea you're doing, there's a trade-off there, and they can recycle that. So, but the real point I called is to call about South Korea and China.
Okay, sure.
Well, China's stealing all the jobs out of the world. Like this year, their level, their amount of pants they're going to send to our country is going up 1,600% of men's pants.
Boy.
So that's just like sucking the jobs out of us, and there's no way we can compete with that. And the other point is North Korea is going nuts. Are we going to be caught with our pants down when, excuse all the us and thus,
that's all right.
When we're in Iraq and in the Middle East chasing after money that, while they're increasing their profits on oil, are sucking the life of, out of whatever's left of our SUV industry over here. I know you're not a big proponent of SUVs, but that's how a lot of us around this area make our money, and those of us who don't depend on those who do to make money off of them.
Pat, I have a full-size sedan. It's not like I have this little teeny, you know.
Hey, well, they're just debasing our industry for quick profit, and the laws of diminishing return are going to ruin this country. It's just like some rich king who robs the riches of the country and splits. That's what's happening to us.
You got it. All right. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your call. Now, I mean, whenever people say that I'm being too radical or too extreme or too weird or anything like that, it just brings out the worst in me. I mean, I don't shrink from it, maybe as Hayes was advising me. So here, this is not very pleasant, but I think pretty interesting. The police in Germany, I don't know, why are they trying to solve this? There's been, in Germany, when dogs poop on the sidewalk, there's people that have been going around with little flags with a photograph of Bush on it and sticking it in the dog poo. So this is what German cops are spending. They don't have much crime, you know, like us. So there's all this dog poo with Bush flags in it. You can go to Make You Think, or I'm sorry, Made, M-A-D-E, MadeYouThink.org. You can get the little flags because it's beginning to happen here as well. MadeYouThink.org. Now, let me tell you this. As a dog owner, I always think the people that don't clean up their dog's poop are Republicans. Yeah, because, yeah, they're the screw people, you know, stuff like that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe tell me, is that just a prejudice? I mean, I know there are Republicans that pick up their dog's poop. Yeah, they have little pooper scoopers. You can take a bag inside out. But you don't want to leave that around. So the best way not to have this take root in America, that is to have thousands of, what would you call, piles of dog poo with Bush flags in it, is to clean it up. Then you won't have to worry about it. If you go to madeyouthink.org, they even will send you free these Bush flags that you can use however you want. But think about this. Maybe it'd be good for Republicans. Maybe you could just, you know, I don't know, stick it in your Jell-O molds or something like that. Whatever. All right, let's try Big Brady again in Lake Orion. Okay, you're there. Go ahead.
Yo, what's up, Peter, man? I've been saying, like, the whole life I've been living, man, alcohol is a waste of a life, man. If people were to start using mind-altering tools, you know, it'd be a waste of time for, like, all this violence and jail and stuff. If they were to start using mind-altering tools and substances, they'd expand their mind and see the realizing of life, man, not fucking doing...
Woo! They get you off the air. See you later, Big Brady. Okay. Let's see. Let's go to, this could be either way, but this is Luther in Troy. Hi, Luther, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
Doing great.
It's good to talk to you. I had three topics I wanted to talk to you about real quick, and I enjoyed that Rush song, and I enjoy you being who you are, and doing what you feel.
Let me just interrupt you 1 second. I forgot to mention that I played this song with somebody that sounded exactly like Rush Limbaugh singing "I'm a Nazi." And for those of you who thought that was awful or insulting or unfair, for one thing, he's awful and unfair and insulting to people. But I can't imagine a bigger compliment. I mean, if somebody played an imitation of my voice singing "I'm a Commie" or something like that, probably most people wouldn't even, you know, outside of this WRF audience, wouldn't even know who it was. So the very fact that you could have a parody of that nature, assuming that wasn't him, is in some ways a real compliment. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think it's funny. I have trouble figuring out whether or not it's all samples or whether it's someone doing samples.
But I don't know. Yeah.
I've heard that the Real ID Act, the National ID program, may be tagged to the bill that is probably going to be voted on either tomorrow or Tuesday, at least in the next couple days, the supplemental spending bill.
Okay, and they're talking about having a national ID?
They're going to tag it on to that because basically, you know, no one's going to vote to not support the troops after this election.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that won't reach debate in the Senate probably, and it's unfortunate, but I guess.
I think they're not going to have a national. I mean, they can't. There's no money. It would cost hundreds of millions of dollars to institute that.
Well, they're spending like crazy as it is. You know, there seems to be no restraint from the so-called conservative leadership and in the three branches of our government right now. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Well,
but if we got something to say about it, we can contact our representatives, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, in a way, I have a national ID. Well, I use primarily when I'm flying or going to Canada, which is my passport. But still, having that, I mean, what do we need it for?
Where are they going to use it's probably the question. But
yeah.
I guess we can call them. I found out the toll-free number for contacting your representative.
Sure. What is it?
It's 877 SOBUSOB.
What?
It's funny how it turns out, but it's 877 SOBUSOB.
Yes, sir.
And so voice in on that. And that new Enron movie that came out.
Yeah.
The smartest guys in the room.
Right.
I saw it tonight and it was excellent.
Where is it? At the Maine?
I know it's at the Maple Art, and I think it's at the Main.
Okay, yeah.
It's totally worth seeing.
Yeah, you know, it was, as I've said any number of times, the Enron scandal, which threatened to eat up the Bush administration at a point when their ratings were falling precipitously in 2002. That's when they played the Iraq card. That's when they said, okay, we got to make up this BS about their being... weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So, yeah, that'd be a great one to see. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. By the way, this sounds like something... How many times have you heard this? How many hundreds of millions are they going to spend in order to, to realize that Saddam Hussein never had any weapons of mass destruction? Wrapping up his investigation into Saddam Hussein's purported arsenal, the CIA's top weapons hunter in Iraq said his search for weapons of mass destruction, quote, had been exhausted without finding any. Now, why did he spend these hundreds of millions of dollars? You and I knew. The vast majority of us here listening to this broadcast knew there weren't any. And how did I know? I knew that from reading reports in the mainstream press. I mean, it was all such an obvious lie. And so many people are dead. So much of our treasury has been drained because of this purposeful misrepresentation. In other words, a lie. Let's see. Some of you say, well, maybe he took him to Syria. Right, that was it. Nor did Charles Dulfer, head of the Iraq Survey Group for the U.S., find any evidence that such weapons were shipped officially from Iraq to Syria to be hidden before the U.S. invasion. So, that's more BS as well. Yeah, he says it was unlikely that an official transfer of weapons of mass destruction material from Iraq to Syria took place. So it's all just a lie. Iran and North Korea want weapons of mass destruction, as so many other countries do in this world, in order to forestall the possibility of a U.S. invasion. There was enough facts to know that there were no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, you really had to not be paying attention, which I hate to say, but it was typical of many Americans. I mean, in this critical decision. I mean, the Bush Co. and the official liars knew that most people don't pay much attention. And if everybody gets on TV and says, oh, yeah, they've got weapons of mass destruction and nukes and poison gas and sarin and, you know, stuff like that, people will believe it. So you really had to be paying attention. But there was enough evidence out there, hard, cold, solid evidence for me to know, and many of you at least, to know that there weren't any. But there was also a logical deal. that if there were weapons of mass destruction in the hands of the Iraqis, that the United States would not have invaded. That's why Iran probably will be bombed pretty soon, particularly as Bush's ratings bomb, then they'll also bomb Iran. But they're not going to bomb North Korea, because North Korea has operational nuclear missiles. So they're safe. Nothing's going to happen to them. So the idea, the message here, and Bush has made the world tremendously more unsafe by all the precipitous actions in Afghanistan and Iraq. The message is, if you have weapons of mass destruction, you do not get invaded. And if you don't, you do. So what the hell is, what the hell is the message here? This is Ted in Riverview. Ted, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, listen, I got to tell you, man, I think you're half nuts. And I don't think that you really have a firm base in reality.
How come?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, okay. All right, you're going to take the side of of a dictator that's 3,000, 4,000, 10,000 miles away, but you'll deny your own government, okay?
Whose side? I don't know. What dictator are you talking about? You mean some of these? Well, no, I don't even know who you mean. What dictator's side am I taking?
Well, okay. All right. You're going to take the double negative approach to Saddam Hussein, okay?
What?
And, yeah.
I don't know what you mean.
That, well, okay. You're gonna say that he didn't have the weapons. You're sure of it. But yet you know nothing of his will. You know nothing of what he wanted to do. But you're sure that we're wrong. Our government was out of line. Come on, man.
Well, wait a minute. Our government said there were weapons of mass destruction, and there weren't any. And there's no reason to suspect that Saddam Hussein was doing anything differently than what he said. That they had divested themselves of all the weapons of mass destruction. All the inspections said that. There was an ongoing inspection that would have shown very, very quickly that there weren't any. So, well, I mean, well, I could put the question back to you, Ted. Why in the world would you respect the opinion of a bunch of politicians that that don't have any interest in their minds other than their own? Why are you so dumb?
Why do you trust the double negative of what they might or what they didn't have?
Wait. We know. Here's what it was. They said they were going to invade Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction. I knew at the time, millions of people around the world knew the same thing, that Bush was lying, that Condoleezza Rice was lying, that Colin Powell was lying, that Dick Cheney was lying, that Rumsfeld was lying, and it all turned out to be correct. So this invasion, all the deaths of the Americans, all the deaths of the Iraqis were because, at best, if you want to be charitable, these people all made an awful miscalculation and mistake, didn't they?
By not supporting your government. Your government was looking out for the best of these people here.
No, man, you are a sucker of the first magnitude. Why would you think that these people have any interest other than oil interest and interest of wealth? Why would you ascribe to George W. Bush that our government?
Bill Clinton said that they had weapons of mass destruction, okay? They're evil. They're going to use it on us. They're going to hurt our people.
But they didn't have any, Ted. They were wrong. Bill Clinton was wrong. George Bush was wrong. But the only thing was that there was no intention of Bill Clinton to go to war. I mean, maybe he would do this and that to get attention drawn away from what was going on, but not like this. Not because there's this Enron scandal, because the Republicans had planned for a long time an invasion of Iraq, not anything to do with, because you got to remember, who set Saddam Hussein up in the first place was particularly Reagan and then his dad, and then, then he got a little out of hand, and they figured, well, this is going to work good, too. We're going to get in there and pummel a little. But the real neocons wanted control of the oil of that region, and they don't care how many Iraqis they kill, and they don't care how many Americans are killed. And you, who I assume, living in Riverview, are an average working class American, are supporting these wealthy imperialists who have no interest in the common people of any country, and you're being played for a sucker, my friend.
You are my friend, and I respect you a lot, but you know what? They're looking out for us, and they have our best interests at heart. You can make me look like an idiot all you want, but the truth is, there's no proof of what you're saying.
Okay. Okay, let's leave it at that. You get the last word. Fair enough? What? I give the guy the last word. He goes, All right. I don't know. What more can I do than give somebody the last word? I mean, we've been around the block with this. These people have the best interest of our... Okay. Let me see. You don't have next up here, Jay, so I'm just going to take the person that's been waiting the longest. It's Fred in Leonard, Michigan. Fred, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Hey, I just wanted to call and mention about that caller that called in. I apologize for even having him say something like that.
Like what?
Well, he just said and you had to cut him off.
Oh, I didn't cut him off. You mean the last guy?
No, not the last guy. The guy you had to get off the air.
Oh.
I can't believe he went and did something like that. After Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake messed it up for all the DJs across the country, he goes and does something like that. Doesn't he realize what that can cost you and Riff?
You know, actually, it's not true. I mean, after hours like this, it's okay. I just don't, you know, people... It wasn't a problem, but I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate your concern.
Yeah, I support you guys all the time. I listen to the Riff 24/7 just about. I sleep with the radio on.
Yikes!
So I talked to Arthur Penhollow, and he's told me a lot of things. How a lot of things change. You can't hardly say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And to come up with something like that, I mean, I don't know what was wrong with the guy. I think he should call back and apologize himself. But that's really can't be done on the radio.
Well, you know what, though? Like the last guy, I mean, he just got kind of upset, and he almost said the same thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I can understand getting upset, too, but, you know, you got to watch what you say, especially when you're on the air like that. I mean, that could come back and cost Peter Werby, not alone just the Riff.
Well, you know, not necessarily. I mean, because, like I say, if I said it, I mean, I got to watch my mouth. And every once in a while, I get blown out stuff, and so I got to watch it. But I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Fred. Thanks for calling in from Leonard. Hey, by the way, at 1 a.m. Eastern time, it's about 12:27 right now, I have a couple of interviews. The first one is going to be with, I can't remember his name. Anyways, wrote a book called Can't Find My Way Home, the old Blind Faith song, the title, about Stoned America, 1945 to 2000. And then we're going to have the director of the Michigan Opera Theater on following that. And you think, opera? WRIF? Listen up. I think you'll appreciate the interview considerably. Hope so, at least. So that'll be in about a half an hour. Meantime, we're still live. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and hi to James in Westland. James, you're on the air.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I got a couple of things I want to say. First, I really enjoyed that song about Rush Limbaugh, and I have a suggestion.
Right.
Play that at the beginning of every show. Seriously. That should be your intro.
Yeah.
Okay. Second thing, Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm. Osama bin Forgotten, we call him.
Well, see, here's the thing. I know why.
Why?
Forgotten.
Why?
Because Bush is not going to blow up his best friend.
Because
The bin Ladens are Bush's best friends. You're not going to kill your scapegoat.
Well,
you're not going to kill your best friend, are you?
It doesn't work. He certainly didn't get much mileage out of, for instance, capturing Saddam Hussein. And I think I think if they could kill Osama bin Laden, they'd probably do it. Bush would consider that a feather in his cap. But where is this guy? Maybe he's dead even. Who knows?
And also consider this. Osama bin Laden's look is very modified. It could be changed easily.
I mean,
easily.
He could be working
in a... He could take off the turban, shave. He could come over here and nobody would know that's him.
He could be working in a Starbucks out in Royal Oak.
Yeah, he could be working in a gas station.
Dude, wow.
Yeah.
It makes me nervous.
Yeah. And there's a couple of countries that I think that we are never going to attack. Why?
Why?
Because they're a part of a supply chain that affects us. We are not going to bomb our own business partners.
Like Saudi Arabia.
Like Saudi Arabia, like China,
mm-hmm.
Korea. The reason why we don't go out to Korea?
Because
they make half the shit we buy.
Well, You said one of those words, too. So you're bye-bye. But let me just tell you before you go. You're talking to, you know, distinguish between North and South Korea. South Korea does make a lot of our imports, obviously. There was some question earlier about, wait a minute, where'd that go? Can't find it. Oh, well. Someone was, there was a whole question about my style and whether I was being too confrontational or too radical or anything like that, but I lost it. They were saying, just stay as sweet as you are. All right, we'll be right back.
Listening to WRIF.com. Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRIF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRIF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. Two to three-person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
This is WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment, located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com. Riff Rock. Rocks. Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a three-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
Rip Rocks.
A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on our 2005 Harley-Davidson Fat Boy. The 6th annual MDA Black and Blue Ball. May 6th at the Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn. Call for tickets at 586-274-9000. From Ford Motor Company, Motor City Harley-Davidson, Pepsi Bottling Group, and 101 WRIF.
Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. Welcome back to our final segment at 1 a.m. Eastern Time here in Detroit. We'll turn it over to the interviews I've done previously, including one on the impact, culturally, politically, everything else, of the effect of drug prohibition, 1945 to 2000, and then a discussion of Michigan Opera as well, Michigan Opera Theater. And including this incredible new performance, world premiere that they're going to have here called Margaret Garner, set in the American, actually in Kentucky and Ohio. And it's about escaped slaves. You listen up. It's incredible. There's a lot of talk about having nuclear power again. And this is a big giveaway to the industry. To the nuclear industry that hasn't, well, they haven't sited a plant in 30 years or something like that. As it is, it's cost us, the American taxpayer, billions of dollars. This is another transfer of wealth. This is another redistribution of wealth between us, the average taxpayer, and the wealthy of this country. So when you get all of these right-wingers saying, you want a redistribution of wealth. There's been this incredible redistribution of wealth over the last 30 years, but it's all been coming from us, the ordinary person, to the wealthy. And I had a lot of stuff on here, but I'm not going to go into that. But one thing, nuclear power, all right, so it uses this fuel, and then what happens to it? It has to be stored safely, in some cases, up to a quarter of a million years. Now, humans, as we know us, I mean, they've been pushing it back farther and farther, but it was 20,000 years, 50,000 years, maybe, that people now, the scientists say, perhaps humans have been on the planet for 100,000 years. Now, the waste that is coming from Fermi 2 down the road in Monroe, Michigan, that's what I always say when I've spoken there, the home of General George Custer and Fermi 2. Anyway, what a pairing. Anyway, that has to be held in some cases five times longer than the period of time that humans have even been on the planet in the form we are now, Homo sapiens. So where are we putting this stuff? Nowhere. There's absolutely nowhere to put it. And as we talk, more and more waste is being created, and there's nowhere to put this poisonous substance. And a federal judge has just ordered the Energy Department to explain why it believes that it will ever be possible to open the Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository in Nevada. In her ruling, Judge Susan G. Braden of the Court of Federal Claims said there is no evidence that Yucca Mountain would ever be licensed. So there is absolutely nowhere to put this poisonous, most dangerous substance that has ever been on the planet. And this is what Bush once more of. These people are dangerous to our health. As my pal Mike Malloy says, have I told you yet tonight how much I hate these people? Why I hate them, too. I know you're not supposed to hate people. It's not good. Not a good Buddhist, hating people. But they are so destroying the quality of our lives on every level. And now they're threatening the fabric of life itself. These people are unchecked, out of control madmen. And that's who have our future in their hand. That's why I was surprised that person Ted said, we got to trust them because they have our best interests in mind. And I've sort of lost what somebody said here. Where is that? I don't know, somebody commented on him. Here. This is Antonio says, that Ted guy who called in is a sucker and an idiot. He trusts what the president says. What a joke, believing anything he says. I applaud your show and WRIF for your show every Sunday. Well, that's just sort of self-serving here. Let me see one more thing. This is always please print out this email and show this to the FCC as proof that at least one faithful listener was not offended by the naughty words that were mistakenly broadcast on the air. In fact, due to those naughty words, I will now go and purchase many of the fine products and services that were advertised on your show. Happy May Day from Todd. Thank you, Todd, for writing into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. But, you know, it's just supposed to be us adults up at this time of night anyways. Well, let's see. I think we're going to go to this one. Here's James calling from Wisconsin. James, hi. What city are you in?
Kenosha.
Kenosha, hi. Welcome. You're on the air. It's Peter Werby with you.
Thanks, Peter. This past week we had Mr. Bush grace us with one of his rare primetime press conferences.
Right.
Which was pretty unremarkable, except for the fact that three of the networks cut away early to join their scheduled programming during Sweeps Week.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite a comment on just exactly what we were going to get from Bush. But one thing I wanted to talk about in terms of, you've had a couple callers talk about you being too radical or too left tonight. The real outrage, as far as I'm concerned, should be directed at this policy of rendition, which Bush was asked about. I mean, we're literally disappearing people off the planet and shipping them off to be tortured with a wink and a nod and this claim that, you know, we're operating within the law. Well,
the United States is now a torture state. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We both, as a matter of policy that was okayed by the higher-ups, the Rumsfeld and Gonzales and the generals, and said they've got the poor schmucks that carried it out being the scapegoats. But you're right. The rendition is where the United States captures people that are suspects and ships them off to be hideously tortured by our allies.
It's amazing that we still want to make the claim that we're the good guys. You know, if we had actual evidence that these people were guilty of some sort of terrorist crime or activity, well, then why aren't we then capturing them and bringing them into a court of law like I thought we were all about?
Well, no, that's not the intent. I mean, but what they would argue was that it's more important to gain information that would forestall terror attacks. Of course, what we find out is that any interrogator knows that that torture is not a good way to get information out of people. I mean, someone says, all right, tell us where your next attack is or we're going to torture you. I'd say, my next attack is going to be next Thursday, at Tiger Stadium or something like that. Also, there is an ethical quality that changes, as you said, the definitions of who we are as a society. And also, it belies the fact that we're interested in democracy or international law when we support places like Egypt and Syria and Uzbekistan and what have you.
We're actually talking in a positive vein with Saddam, which is absolutely amazing considering what's going on in Darfur. The other thing is Bush then claims that we should continue this policy because it protects Americans, when in fact, I mean, this doesn't take place in a vacuum, and the concept of blowback is certainly going to be a result of this policy, and so we become less safe as a result.
Well, yeah, my wife has a pin on that says we're making enemies faster than we are killing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here, this is from the New York Times today. U.S. recruits a rough ally to be a jailer. 7 months before September 11, 2001, the State Department issued a human rights report on Uzbekistan. It was a litany of horrors. The police repeatedly tortured prisoners, State Department officials wrote, noting that the most common techniques were beating, often with blunt weapons, and asphyxiation with a gas mask. Separately, international human rights groups had reported that torture in Uzbek jails included boiling of body parts, using electroshock on genitals, and plucking off fingernails and toenails with pliers. Two prisoners were boiled to death, the groups reported. And the State Department said, Uzbekistan is an authoritarian state with limited civil rights. Immediately after the September 11th attacks, however, the Bush administration turned to Uzbekistan as a partner in fighting global terrorism. Well, this is an internal terror state, and this is who Bush has put us in bed with. And let me tell you, if you're listening and you think, good, I hope they really do those people, you are one sick puppy. And hence, ethically no different than the kind of people that thought that they could take human life in the manner that occurred on September 11th. You are no different than the terrorists, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, I'm not talking to you, James.
In fact, it's almost a step beyond because it's so personalized. I mean, on September 11th, these people flew these planes into these buildings that were certainly occupied. They knew they were occupied, but they were faceless. You're plucking people off the street, individuals with families, and then subjecting them to this sort of thing. That's even a step closer to the sickness that you referred to.
Well, yeah, and also, James, is that as we know, all the torture, which is a matter of U.S. policy, and everywhere from Guantanamo to Afghanistan to Iraq and all these secret prisons that the CIA runs across the world, is that these aren't people that they knew were terrorists or something like that. In fact, particularly in Iraq, it was just virtually a roundup in which common criminals were tortured and abused and beaten and killed in many parts of the world. On suspicion or denunciation, it's a terrible shame. I mean, George W. Bush has disgraced America before the world, and he and Rumsfeld and the rest of them, both for their crime against peace by invading Iraq on in violation of international law, and the fact that torture has become an official part of American policy, all of these guys belong in the world court, in the criminal docket. They're war criminals.
Which is exactly why we don't support the world court. And that happened early in his term, before any of the wars broke out or any of the attack on September 11th. They stepped away from the world court immediately when he became president back in 2000. So they knew where they were going with.
Yeah, well, they were fearful, as like Henry Kissinger, who's been subpoenaed before, I forgot how many courts of how many different countries for the war crimes he's been involved in over the years. I mean, a guy can't even go all the places he'd like to in the world, and Bush is fearful the same thing might happen to his people. James, thanks for calling in from Wisconsin. Appreciate it.
Thanks
for listening as well. And this goes back to the extreme deal. I mean, if you think what I'm saying is outrageous, extreme, inappropriate, whatever, hey, yeah, for one thing, these right-wing maniacs get away with stuff much farther over the edge than anything I'm saying. And if you don't like it, you know, sort of lump it. I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying. And just like when I listen to this toxic right-wing pollution that dominates the airwaves, 90-95%, even though the country is nowhere split like that, that's what I have to do. I have to just lump it. So, you know, don't get your shorts in an uproar, okay? Here's Mike from Novi. Mike, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. How are you?
Doing good, thanks.
Good. My primary reason for calling, I guess, is and it kind of goes to the comment about, you know, being radical, and you just stole part of my thunder. You know, there's an AM station, what do they call themselves, the 50,000-watt blowtorch, that's devoted from start to finish, except for part of an afternoon drive time program, that is, you know, very much right wing, and you know, I mean, they don't try and hide the fact they sell that, but it's all over the place. To try and find the other side of things is very difficult to do.
Sure, it is. And in fact, well, go ahead.
So I was just going to say, and this is a compliment to you. At least for the most part, when you disagree with somebody, you're at least polite about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fat bimbo that you were talking about, the drug king.
Yeah.
He's a bombastic ass. You know, and he loves belittling people and using the, you know, the idiot words and all this kind of stuff that comes out where, you know, it's just, can we agree to disagree? I mean, what do we wake up in America and it's my way or you're non-patriotic? And it's just,
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, let me tell you, there is a vested interest in keeping this disproportionate right-wing slant to talk radio and either mainstream or corporate or right-wing slant to all the news and the talking heads program. Because if 50%, I mean, even though now, I mean, the Republicans, conservatives are slipping way off 50%, but even if 50% of media had voices similar to mine, I mean, people think I'm too extreme. I mean, people that were just like mainstream Democrats, which I'm not. We wouldn't even heard of Bush. I mean, it's amazing that 50% of the people in the last election, and it was split about even. I mean, what did Bush have, like 50.8%. that still, that 50% of the people were thinking for themselves without the external bombardment of affirmation of their point of view. And we, you know, we all had to think for ourselves, contact ourselves, go to our, you know, websites, that we get the information we need. So the people that run the show here know that if there ever was an equal presentation of information, the right wing would be way history.
Well, I think you're exactly correct, and I think that's where the Karl Roves of the world are genius, especially in this last election, where they reduce it down to a single issue, scare the hell out of the American people, and, you know, they won so many housewives votes because they, you know, they had bombs lurking on every corner, and you don't want to change, you'd never change, you know, captains in the middle of a stream. Baloney.
That's right.
They're involved in a fake war, but they went out and they sold it very well.
Actually, I've got just a little bit of time, and I got to take two more callers. So thank you for yours, and I'm going to get Donna and Al, and then we will go to our interviews. Here is Donna in Chesterfield. Donna, hi. It's Peter Werby.
Hi. No Bush sticker on my bumper.
That's good.
I guess I'm below average. I don't mean no $25,000. I supply for the big three. I don't understand why we have so many foreign people working in our industry. They don't pay our, they don't have taxes taken out.
Yeah, they gotta have taxes taken out, Dana.
No, they don't, for 7 years.
What?
7 years.
That sounds like one of those kind of urban myths. Why would that happen?
Oh, they come, they leave, they go home, as long as they come back and they can work here for 7 years, there's no taxes taken out.
All right, I said that was going to be the last, but somebody email me, because this is the kind of thing I think that sometimes people with great resentment, sometimes that just circulates. I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong. I just never heard this, and I tend to doubt on the face of it that it's correct. So if anybody has anything on that, call talkyes@yahoo.com or give us a quick shout. All right, Donna, let me do this. Let me just check on that. I'm sorry to cut you short, but I want to get Al from Inkster in here. Al, go ahead. You're on the air.
Attack, attack, attack. There's not enough radicals on the radio.
Yeah.
When I started listening to NPR back in the early 80s, Barbara Ehrenreich and Michael Harrington were political commentators on all the NPR stations.
Really?
Nowadays, you got all these think tank people, the, you know, the softcore people. Attack. We are dealing with evil here. We're dealing with an evil that's, you know, caused me to seriously rethink commitments to nonviolence.
Well, don't do that.
So, just keep attacking.
Wait a minute. Hold on here. I want to see if I can find something. You're familiar with the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies, right?
IWW, yep.
IWW.org. They are a union that's celebrating its centenary this year. And here, this is what T-Bone Slim said. Wherever you find injustice, the proper form of politeness is attack. So,
attack. If Kerry had attacked when they did the Swift Boat ads and said, "Hey, George, let's talk about your war record." Oh, I'm sorry, you don't have one. Let's talk about your post-war. Well, you don't have a war record, so you can't have a post-war record. If Kerry had stood up and said, you know, the same thing he had said at Wayne State,
yeah,
how many people are going to be the last person to die for a mistake? Instead of saying mistake, if he said, how many people are going to be the last one to die for a lie, he'd be president today.
Well, I certainly think that he didn't play his strong cards, and he got bad advice all along the way.
And you got to cause the tides of the world to splutter out like the burning crosses they are in the darkness of night.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us. I was trying to get back to my email because I had to go find that quote, but I guess we're going to have to leave Donna's question unanswered for right now. But, well, let me find my spots, and if I find out some information in the interim, right before we do our interview, I'll come back with that. So stay tuned. I think you're going to enjoy what follows.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRIF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash plus the title of 2005 WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRIF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
This is WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Shields, ideal for business lunches and family dinners, with locations in Southfield, Troy, Dearborn, Commerce Township, and their newest location in Warren. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Two for Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff rocks.
Like what you hear on the riff? Then why not get your riff rock to go? Download all your favorite riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff rocks. Rocks.
A night of black leather, hot bands, great food, wicked bikes, and more. Plus, you can bid on a 2005 Harley-Davidson Fatboy. 6th Annual MDA Black and Blue Ball. May 6th at the Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn. Call for tickets at 586-274-9000. From Ford Motor Company, Motor City Harley-Davidson, Pepsi Bottling Group, and 101 WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Back live, we'll get your interviews on. Just a second, Donna had called in and said that her understanding was that people that weren't citizens didn't have to pay taxes for 7 years. According to immigrantlegaladvocacy.org, immigrantlegaladvocacy.org, thanks to JV for sending this, says non-citizens who are living and working in the United States are expected to file income tax returns for every year that they earn enough to have a tax liability, no matter what their immigration status is. So if people aren't paying taxes, they're breaking the law. Here's our interview. Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you as usual. A wonderful book has come my way. It was in hardcover a few years ago, now in paper. I Can't Find My Way Back Home. It's America in the Great Stoned Age, 1945 to 2000. And the author is Martin Torgoff. He's been a contributing editor of Interview and a producer for CNN's World Beat. He's a documentary filmmaker, the author of several books, including the best-selling Elvis, We Love You Tender, and American Fool, The Roots and Improbable Rise of John Cougar Mellencamp. And we're talking to him in his home in New York City. Martin Torgoff, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Or were we such a product of the Great Stoned Age we can't remember, neither of us, whether or not I interviewed you when this came out in hardcover?
Well, I like to think that I've regenerated a lot of my brain cells over the last 15 years.
Well.
We are a product of that, and that's why I wrote the book. It was an attempt to understand how our culture has been shaped over the last half century by the use of illicit drugs, and it really has been.
Mm-hmm. You know, I rarely like to rely on press releases, but the one accompanying your book, Can't Find My Way Home, from Simon & Schuster, says illicit drugs, as you were indicating, have transfigured the American cultural landscape in the past half century, leaving their mark on everything from art, music, literature, sexuality, spirituality, pop culture, the economy, and politics, to crime, public health, and national law enforcement policy. And there's no way in the world I ever could have assembled that list in my brain without the help from this. That's why I read from it. But this is absolutely astounding. There was supposed to be a war on drugs. Well, J. Edgar Hoover and Harry Anslinger and Richard Nixon and the rest of them might as well just come with their hands up. I mean, they've lost, eh?
Well, I mean, if you just look at the more recent version of it, Ronald Reagan began a great national crusade against illicit drugs when he took office in 1980. He rolled into office thinking that he had a mandate to roll back drug use in the United States, exactly like he wanted to roll back Soviet expansionism and the size of the federal government. And in 1982, he ran up his battle flag. And since then, we've spent something like $500 billion trying to make this a drug-free America. Now, is it any more of a drug-free America in 2005 than it was in 1982 or 1989 when Bush came in? Or it's an ongoing saga. It's now become a multi-generational experience in this country.
Yeah, part of it, of course, legal. Millions of people having been dragged through the legal system for wanting to change their consciousness. I was just having lunch with someone today, and I said, I guess we took our choice, either a war on drugs or something like a national health program for all of us.
Well, we've certainly made that choice. Now it's really interesting because, there's a real drug reform policy movement in the United States now. I mean, whether you look at it as, some of the medical marijuana initiatives or, sentencing reform, there are a lot of places where people have gotten together and said, here's an area where the war on drugs has just gone too far. And, little by little, incrementally, I think there's more of a sensibility that not only is it not working, but it's not working in ways that have been harmful to this country as well, whether you're looking at civil liberties or a policy like no clean needle exchange in segments of the society, where there's the greatest spread of HIV infection as a result of intravenous needle use. There are many, many areas now where over time the evidence is there. So there's a real drug policy reform movement in this country now, whereas, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't that there. It wasn't that. But even so, any kind of change is going to be so incremental, so slow.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons, of course, that it's so slow, there's certainly not a politician. There's very few people anywhere that will make a public utterance in this that would declare drugs to not be harmful, dreadful, crime-inducing, mental and physical destructive element. And so maybe, and tell me if we find this in your book, Can't Find My Way Home, where's the positive? All of this is so awful.
Yeah.
Why has it persisted as a national phenomena for so long?
Well, I mean, I think the answer to that question is complicated, and it, you know, the answer is on many levels. It has to do with who we are as Americans, and it has to do with basic human nature. You know, these substances have been around since the beginning of time. You know, psychoactive plants, whether it's cannabis or coca leaf or the opium plant, the grape, you know, ever since man has crushed grapes. This is an old story. It's here, and it's not going anywhere. I mean, of course, what you have here, and this is the story I try to tell in my book, is the uniquely modern American cultural version of it, which is, you know, the greatest consumer society on the face of the earth, you know, the most technologically and industrial advanced society, adopting the use of these on a mass level. You know, that has never really happened before in history. You know, the real core of my book takes place in the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, I begin at the Second World War.
Well, actually,
bebop and the Beat Generation. But it's, you know, in the 60s and in the 70s, that's when it really happens. And that's when we go from a nation in which there are like maybe 500,000 people smoking marijuana to something like 20 to 30 million people smoking marijuana.
Well, one of the, I'm sorry I started to interrupt you, Martin Targoff. And the reason that I did was exactly to ask you that, and you kind of answered it. You talk in your book, Can't Find My Way Home, of course, the title taken from the Blind Faith tune of the same name. But in the subtitle, American the Great Stoned Age, 1945, people, a lot of people listening probably say, wow, did anybody do drugs before 1966 or something like that?
Yeah.
You quickly went over it, you know, bebop and beats. Talk about why you began in 1945. Certainly, you know, you go back into the 1930s, and there's what, the old Cab Calloway song.
The reefer culture of the 30s,
sure.
And
but,
you know, well, look, I mean, just briefly encapsulating it, you know, in 1914 with the Harrison Narcotic Act, we declared narcotics to be illegal in this country. And from that moment on, there was a drug underground. It wasn't a large one, but it existed. And in the 30s, you know, marijuana found its way into the United States over the border with the Mexican laborers and, you know, into New Orleans and then up the river with the jazz musicians to Chicago. You can almost follow it along with Louis Armstrong in the early 20s, and then it made its way over to New York and took root in the, you know, the great Harlem reefer culture of the 30s that, you know, coalesced around swing music. And that was also the time of the first national drug crusade, Harry Anslinger, the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, which declared marijuana illegal.
And we think of swing as being so square.
That's right, we do. And in point of fact, those musicians were high as kites. Lester Young, I mean, one after another, Billie Holiday.
Benny Goodman, yeah.
And so, you know, the musical culture has always had a relationship with, you know, mind-expanding substances. But, you know, what happened in this country was totally unique with it. And, you know, then you had these musicians, this underground society of vipers. So by the end of the Second World War, when the war is over and everyone's coming back to build the great American century, you have a number of things happen. You have these two movements in the United States. Bebop, who of course were, you know, the musicians like Charlie Parker and Miles Davis and John Coltrane. It was a sensibility, and some of the great genius artists of that time became junkies. They really didn't know what they were getting involved with. At the same time, the then mafia was just beginning to organize the global trade in heroin, and of course their marketplace that they picked was Harlem. So you have really what began the first drug epidemic in modern American history in Harlem. Claude Brown chronicles it in his wonderful classic book, Man-Child in the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the late 40s and through the 50s, that was going on with heroin. But then you have these writers, you know, this small group of writers, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs. These guys were fascinated with drugs, and they evolved a whole body of literature that was written in the authentic language of people who use drugs as a way of life. And the characters used drugs in the book, and it was very much identified with a sort of like bohemian revolt. This was new. And the kids, the high school kids of the late 1950s who were attracted to this, music and to this literature, they knew that, it was the ultimate evil. I mean, there had been wild-eyed anti-drug films for almost 20 years by that point, films like Reefer Madness and Cocaine Fiends that we've seen. The society was telling everyone, that if you use drugs, you're going to become an axe murderer or a dope fiend. And yet, these middle-class high school kids gravitated towards it. They were fascinated by it and everything that it represented. And it represented many different things. I mean, it was not just, kicks. It was, there was something powerfully cultural. There was a sort of political aspect to it.
Well, I was going to say, then and even now, I mean, let's talk about the most benign of illegal substances, marijuana. You knew it was an act of rebellion in and of itself, forgetting about the impact it would have on your consciousness. And anyone who does it today, a middle-class lawyer or a high school kid or wherever, they know that they are breaking the law. They know that they're involved in a transgression, and that's part of the appeal.
Yeah, it is part of the appeal. And, I was a teenager growing up in the 1960s. I came of age in that period where there was the biggest surge of drug use statistically in the history of the country. And my father was a kid in the 1930s, and they grew up thinking that if, anyone smoked marijuana, they were going to become a heroin addict. And that's, of course, what he told me. And as soon as I, my experience indicated otherwise, I felt empowered to just, act out and do it more.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, at that time, there was the music. As interesting and revolutionary as bebop was as a form of jazz, it had nowhere near the impact of the music of the 1960s on a whole generation of people and their attraction, the allure to use drugs. I mean, I don't have to tell you the groups or the titles because you play them
sure.
on the radio station all the time.
Right.
I mean, these became like anthems. These were manifestos of drug use, whether it was, Grace Slick and White Rabbit or the Beatles' A Day in a Life, the music of Hendrix. It just goes on and on and on. It was just something that had never really happened before. These were artists using drugs, specifically psychedelics and marijuana, making music under the influence of these drugs for people who are going to be under the influence of the same drugs in an age of mass media. That had never happened before.
The book is Can't Find My Way Home. Subtitle is America in the Great Stoned Age, 1945 to 2000. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, the author, Martin Torgoff. The book is available now in paper. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Well, so here we have this mass cultural phenomena that takes that brings. If we add it up, everyone who has smoked marijuana, which is probably vast, far and away the vast number of people who have,
it is 3/4.
Okay. So we're talking about tens of millions of people.
Well, I'll tell you what the latest statistics are.
Sure.
I mean, I'm a little skeptical of the accuracy of government statistics on drugs to begin with, but I can cite them pretty fluently. And last year, the Department of Health and Human Services did a survey, over 90 million Americans admit to using an illicit substance at some point in their lifetime. 3/4 of that number are marijuana experiences. Well, that translates to roughly 40% of the population. Now, it used to be 70 million. I mean, that was the figure that most people sort of worked with. And, you know, that meant that almost 1 in 4 Americans had done it, and people would think, well, my God, that's a staggering statistic.
Mm-hmm.
But in point of fact, it's even more than that. It's now over 90 million.
Well, I will publicly admit to experiment. What do they always say? Experimenting with marijuana in college, right? That's what is fashionable today. You know, actually, during the Democratic primary last year, there was one panel in which people, all the candidates were asked whether or not they had ever used marijuana. And everyone other than, I can't think of his name, the Reverend from New York, Sharpton.
Al Sharpton.
Yeah, Al Sharpton. He said, I'm a minister. I never used it.
Yeah.
Everyone else just kind of said, yeah, and then it was not an issue. So
yeah.
On one hand, as you said earlier, that there are great efforts made towards drug policy reform. I mean, the war on drugs has just been this hideous waste of money, this tragic human toll that it's taken. And yet, the arrests continue. The people's lives are ruined, not so much by the drugs as by the law. And that continues apace.
Yeah, it does. And it's not going to stop any time soon. I mean, especially now that, the sort of right wing is so entrenched in this country. The Republican Party has a base of something like, 60 million religious conservatives. And it's very hard to talk rationally about the war on drugs and drug policy reform with these people, because they tend to see these substances as tools of Satan, quite literally. I mean, you can't have a rational discussion about drugs with these people. And in general, conservatives tend to be with the drug war. It's such an orthodoxy to them. It's so ideological, the fervor, the belief that they are evil and that the only way to deal with them is through prohibition and punitive policy and that kind of thing.
Don't they want the government off our back? Isn't it one of their little mantras? What happened
in
this case?
Well, that's the libertarian wing of the Republican Party. And even that is a little bit iffy about the drug war. Those are the Republicans that are critical of the war on drugs, is the libertarians. The interesting thing is they are as kind of illogical about the drug war as, the Democrats, the liberals, used to be about welfare reform. I mean, most of the time they weren't interested in whether it was working or not. You know, it was so deeply entrenched in their political philosophy, in their cultural ideology, that, it was like a fundamentalist observer in a religious faith or something. And that's why any kind of change in drug policy is going to be painfully slow.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the marijuana initiatives. They pass over and over again, and yet the government steadfastly refuses to allow the will of the people.
Well, what's in this Puritan culture? I mean, on the cover of your book, Can't Find My Way Home, you quote from the New York Times book review, and it says, in part, an exuberant chronicle of ecstatic inebriation. And I'm a couple times talking on the air about the use of the drug ecstasy. I said, you take this drug, it makes you want to love everyone and dance all night, call the cops, you know.
I mean,
so what is ingrained in this Puritanism that, and this may be, you know, beyond, I mean, I don't have any real answers for it beyond the scope of your book, but ecstatic inebriation, what's so bad about that? I mean, let me just frame it another way. One of the problems is there's no boundaries in this society. Other, like, societies that use intoxication and religious rites and what have you, pre-technological societies, they're used very specifically. Here, there's one of the problems, and I think that's what leads to abuse on a small by a small minority of people, is that there are no boundaries.
No, there are no boundaries, and I think we're hurt by that. We're hurt by a lot of things about our national drug policy. To me, one of the saddest things that I found, look, I worked on this book a long time. It took me over a decade to do it. It comes out of my own experience, using drugs, abusing drugs, having to give them up eventually, having to come to terms with my whole past about it, and my whole generation. It was an attempt to understand my whole generation's experience. But one of the things that I really found was, as we've now gotten older and had our own kids, I mean, you're looking like two or three generations down the line from my father, who told me, please don't smoke marijuana because you're going to become a heroin addict. And yet, what happens over and over again is that there's a kind of cultural amnesia about it. We are not allowed to be honest about it, and therefore, what gets lived and learned, what really gets accrued in the way of knowledge and wisdom about it, does not get passed on.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only do we not learn, but we get kind of damned to make the same mistakes over and over again.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. I actually have two very important questions, I think, and kind of personal. So you answer them however you want, Martin Torgoff. After listening to what we've talked about, someone could say, well, your dad was right. I mean, you, as you just said, you were involved in drug abuse, so dad's old advice from the 1960s was correct.
No, he was wrong. He told me I was going to become a heroin addict, and I never did.
Okay.
And it's ironic, too, because I never even got close to being a heroin addict. I never stuck a needle in my arm.
I never saw any heroin in all the years of the 60s and 70s. I never even saw any. Go ahead.
No, but that doesn't mean that I did not damage myself on, you know, like a ton of cocaine and alcohol and all kinds of other things that were around. And it wasn't even so much the substances themselves that caused me any kind of damage. It was the sort of waste of time, the squandering of personal resources over the years. I mean, I was very lucky. I mean, there were people who just sort of crashed and burned spectacularly.
Sure.
And I was never in that category. But there's no doubt about the fact that I abused drugs, you know, willingly and consciously. And so did all of my friends, and to a large degree, so did my generation. Do I regret it? No, ultimately I don't, because I was able to learn something. I was able to take something away from it. And there were a lot of people who didn't. Look, addiction, which is like sort of the dark side of this, there are several secrets, dark secrets underneath this story.
Well,
one of them is addiction.
Yeah.
As anyone knows who's ever been an addict, addiction is a terrible thief. It robs you of money, it robs you of resources, it robs you of sometimes life itself. But the other really dirty secret is that the vast majority of people who did use drugs during that time did not become addicts. They did not become horrific drug abusers. Most of them tended to be moderate social users who, you know, were able to sort of control their use, to use it in some sort of like responsible recreational way. And then, you know, they outgrew it. They moved on with their lives. They were able to set boundaries, intelligent boundaries, and say, you know, yeah, I don't want to smoke pot. You know, if I'm some sort of attorney and I'm preparing a brief for the next day,
absolutely,
you know, I don't want to go home and like smoke this dude.
Let me interrupt you just a second here, because we got just maybe 30 seconds.
Okay.
And the big one is about lessons. We delayed this interview a little because your two-year-old had to be put off for a nap, and we literally have 30 seconds.
Okay.
What do you tell your two-year-old when he or she's a 16-year-old, and he says, Dad, is it right if I smoke marijuana?
Well, I'm gonna sit down, and I'm going to lay it all out for him. I'm going to say, I want you to really understand what you're dealing with here, and I want you to look at it from all the angles. And ultimately, he's going to do what he's going to do. I mean, I would prefer that he not smoke pot if he's going to do it until he's much older,
mm-hmm.
At least out of high school and into college. I think there can be some problems with adolescence and marijuana use. There's no doubt about it. However, having said that, if he persists in doing it, I will try to educate him to be as responsible and as circumspect and as self-responsible and intelligent about it as possible.
And I think we're going to have to leave it at that. My guest, Martin Torgoff, author of Can't Find My Way Home, now in paper, subtitle America in the Great Stoned Age, 1945 to 2000. Great history, great analysis. Check it out. It's Simon & Schuster. Martin Torgoff, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRAF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of 4 tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the 4 tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the RIF. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRAF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today, or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riffed rock.
The way you want it.
Double rock.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff rocks.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock.
The Riff Rock Rocks the Road. Every week, check out WRIF.com for information on upcoming Riff events. Sponsored by Wireless Toys. Announcing no more activation fees. Get reimbursed for the activation fee on any new service, any new provider.
Riff Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Good morning and thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you as usual. This is a rock and roll station, and as many of you know, besides doing these talk shows, that I've been a rock and roll DJ. But in the talk shows, I always talk about being expansive in all of your tastes, and that includes music. And increasingly, and much more so lately, I've been really taken by opera. And people say, opera? And I want to get to the perception of opera on a lot of your parts, but also tell you about an extraordinary opera that is coming to our city and just what a jewel of an opera company and an opera house we have here in Detroit. Joining me to talk about it is the general director of the Michigan Opera Theater in Detroit here, David DiChiara. And David DiChiara has a long history in opera and in music. And I often read from biographies of that what people have accomplished in their field. This would take me probably the rest of the program to talk about all of the accomplishments of David DiChiara. One thing that, although not from Detroit, he was chairman of the Department of Music at Oakland University. But before we talk too much more about that, let's welcome David DiChiara to the Peter Werby Show. Thanks for joining us.
Peter, it's a pleasure to be here.
And I don't know, I mean, how do you feel about the title? I've heard you referred to as Mr. Opera.
Well, I'm not quite sure. I guess it's, I suppose people can't think of anything else to call me. I've been associated with opera for so long in Detroit, it seems to come naturally to everyone.
And almost to the point where I know that everything takes hundreds and hundreds of people to make something go on, but in many ways you are the single driving force behind the creation of the beautiful Detroit Opera House in downtown Detroit. And, I mean, just maybe give us a little bit about that, is how that came from not being here to a dream to reality.
Well, I always think a city is defined by the range of cultural institutions. So when I came here in the early 60s to develop the School of Music at Oakland University, there was no opera. And it was the only large metropolitan area in the country that did not have an opera company. So it seemed to me that that had to be done. And so I kind of set that out as my goal and my mission.
That long ago?
That was, yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
in the 60s.
Michigan Opera Theater is now going to be celebrating its 35th anniversary. And and it's now one of the 10 largest opera companies in the nation. So I'm proud of that, and proud of the fact that Detroit can boast of that, because in the earlier years in starting this opera company, most people just thought that Detroit was not capable of sustaining an opera company. And I always felt very strongly that it provided a kind of an addition to the quality of life and opportunities for students and young singers and musicians and people who are interested in theater, that it was really important to give the art form, like symphony, like art, like all the other things, that it needed to be part of the cultural pattern of what the city could offer to its citizens.
Well, maybe what we should do as we tell the story of the Michigan Opera Theater and the Detroit Opera House is get in some perceptions and misperceptions of opera. I don't mean to make assumptions about the audience, but I'm sure there's many people that think of opera as being stuffy, for the wealthy, just not something that is the exciting and rich and absolutely incredible art form that it is. How, because many times opera was very provocative and shared in its early years or when it came out, the same way that rock and roll was initially received. How did it get from being, you know, what it was and what it is to the kind of this reputation as being stuffy?
The image, right. I mean, for centuries, of course, opera was the art form, just like film is today. And, you know, new operas were being written all the time, and audiences went to the theater, to the opera houses, to see the new work. And rarely did they even pay much attention to the old ones, just like we do with films. Sometimes we look at old films, but we're always waiting for the next thing to come along. I think what happened was, particularly when America was developing here, and the arts, the symphony and all the classical arts were coming into our cities, because there was never any government support as there was in Europe, one had to depend upon the private sector and to depend upon individuals, and primarily individuals of wealth, to help subsidize and sponsor. Because those were the people that were responsible for making it possible, their opening nights and so forth and so on created this image of, you know, of the elite, because they made it a very special occasion, and they would come and they black tie and so forth. And to a certain degree, we do that as well in our opening nights, because people like to celebrate something which is special. But really, opera is just theater with that is sung. I mean, musicals are related to opera. Yes, the operas are often in other languages, but we now have what we call surtitles, which means that above the stage, everything that is sung is translated simultaneously. So those in the audience, for example, who have gone to foreign movies, for example, and are used to simply looking at the translations on the screen, will then realize how useful it is to have translations above the stage.
I know some people, some purists, don't like that, but I have to say it does help me somewhat. And because the stories are often so intricate, you know, the Count of Sardinia, whose twin brother
right.
has kidnapped the, so it does give you a greater understanding of the plot. And the plots are extraordinarily exciting, often political, always heartbreaking.
Well, just like our last production of Tosca.
Oh, that was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Tosca is like has everything that you see in movies and television. You know, it has great love and passion. It has murder. It has suicide. It has attempted rape. It has all of that, but it is all expressed in incredibly beautiful music that enhances the emotions that are involved. You know, I did an opera 2 years ago based on the story of Dead Man Walking. That's the true story of Sister Helen Prejean, who became very good friends with a prisoner. And then, as you know, it was made into a movie with, I think, Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon. And she said to me when she was here that when she was approached by one of the opera companies to, if they could base an opera on her story, she thought, gee, that sounds curious, you know, I don't know, you know, and so, but it was done, and when she went to see the premiere of it, she said, you know, I found the movie wonderful because it was able to be very realistic and give you so much more than you could in a novel visually. She said, but I found the opera was able to make the emotions so much deeper, that it expressed those emotions with such power. I suddenly learned for the first time why opera can be such an amazingly emotional kind of experience.
And why people jump to their feet at the end of an act or an incredible aria or some.
And of course, that opera was in English, too.
Yeah.
So there are operas in English like the opera that we've just commissioned and is going to be having its world premiere here.
My guest is David DiChiara. He's the general director of the Michigan Opera Theater here in Detroit. And we're also talking about the Opera House. I saw operas in the 70s and the 80s, I guess, like the Masonic Temple and the Music Hall and what have you. But suddenly we have this wonderful facility called the Detroit Opera House. And just give us a little bit on that. But we should, let me see, let me look at my clock. Oh, yeah, we got plenty of time because we want to talk about the world premiere of Margaret Garner, which is...
Well, Peter, the Opera House was the natural evolution of having a company that was growing in the city of Detroit and needed to have its own home so that it could be a resource for people year-round. And none of the other theaters in our city had the kind of spaces that opera and ballet on a big scale needs. Needed a very large stage. When you have opera, you have a lot of scenery that has to move in and out. You need a very large orchestra pit. Our orchestra pit accommodates 100 musicians that often some of the operas need. You need lots of dressing rooms. If you have like several hundred chorus and supers and dancers and children's chorus and all those things. So actually, I remember when I was raising the money in the community to do the Opera House, some people would come to me, particularly some of the businessmen, and they'd look at this dilapidated, you know, theater that had been abandoned for years and looked like Berlin in 1945.
Yeah, this is the Broadway Capitol downtown, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And they would say, well, why do you need an opera house? There are all these other theaters. And I said, that's exactly the point. I said, an opera house is not a theater. It's like a factory. Where you sit is only an auditorium. But what an opera house is what everything is behind the stage. It's all of the space. You need to have places for makeup and wigs and costumes and places where people can do their training and rehearsal halls. All of those things is what makes an opera house. And we have the largest stage at the Opera House, actually, between Chicago and I think probably New York.
Well, it's an amazing theater. And your publicist, Dave Blackburn, was telling me about the scenery when I met with him yesterday. What's involved in Tosca, which I saw with my wife, if you only had the orchestra and the scenery, it would be amazing experience. Add to that the absolutely fabulous singers, and you have an experience that is almost indescribable. It is why people jump to their feet shouting bravo.
And yeah, Peter, just to make a point that I've often realized now, because we live in an age now that is completely electronic, and so we're so used to the popular music that we hear, whether it's popular or rock or whatever the genre is, everything is amplified. And so, you know, a popular singer simply puts this microphone up to his or her mouth and can practically whisper. And that is what we hear. You hear a quality of sound, but it is not a natural voice. And a lot of people, particularly younger people, go to the Opera House and they simply are not aware, unless they are told, that these artists who are singing on stage are not amplified. And they are singing with a natural, trained voice, which takes as much training as athletes who are in the Olympics and so forth. And that this voice has to be able to project naturally into a house. Our house seats 2,700 over an orchestra of 70 to 80 musicians. And so this is the beauty of the natural voice, which has been the centerpiece of opera, and until probably the 50s, a musical theater on Broadway until people got used to wanting to hear heavily amplified singing, shows like South Pacific and Oklahoma were all sung on the Broadway stages without amplification. That has changed. The only place now where you hear singing, the natural voice, is in the Opera House.
Incredibly so as well. Michigan Opera Theater General Director is our guest, David DiChiara, and there's an we're fortunate to have this world premiere of Margaret Garner. And tell us some about that. This is a story of an enslaved family's quest for freedom, and talk about drama. I guess we can probably give away a little of the overall plot now. And David, I'll let you do that. And probably the best known person involved with this for the general audience is the person who has written the words, which is the libretto, Toni Morrison, the poet. Tell us about Margaret Garner, though.
Well, Margaret Garner is a true story, and Toni Morrison alludes to the character of Margaret Garner in her famous novel, Beloved, which was then produced as a film by Oprah Winfrey. And, of course, Toni Morrison is not only a Nobel Prize winner and Pulitzer and all of those things. She is really one of the great literary figures of our time. And she had always felt that this dramatic story of a slave woman who was, lived in Kentucky on a plantation, and she had been separated from her husband and her children by the plantation owner, who really wanted her in his house and to actually not only use her as a servant but as kind of a concubine. And when they escape, the husband and Margaret with their children, they escape across the Ohio River to Cincinnati, getting ready to get on the Underground Railroad, this very famous escape for slaves, for which Michigan is justly famous, because many of them came through Michigan and either stayed here or went across into Canada. But they were captured by bounty hunters as well as their owner before they could begin that journey. And Margaret was determined that these children, as well as herself, would never go back into the horrific, life of slavery, and was then decided that she would kill her children and herself so that she would not go back. And before she could do that, she was able to take the life of her children. She was captured. It was a very famous court trial in Cincinnati. This is pre-Civil War, which really kind of focused the attention of the whole country again on the issue of slavery. And one of the incredibly legal battles of this, nobody was denying that she had done this act to save her children from slavery, but the Northerners, or the abolitionists, wanted her accused of murder, because that then was an indication that she was a human being. The slave states wanted her accused of destruction of property.
Oh, boy.
And that was the issue that was so... But the story is more about, not only about that, but it is really about the courage of a woman, and who really goes through a transformation. And and of course, Toni Morrison's lyrics, her words, are pure poetry. They are so moving, because she has taken this story and made it a testament to the courage of people who had to escape from something that was a very difficult chapter in American history.
We usually think of opera and much of what appears at the Michigan Opera Theater of being European and 19th century. I mean, there's some Mozart in the 18th century, entering into the 20th century. But we both, we have kind of two, I wonder whether whether either of these are unique. One, a contemporary opera, and second, based around an African-American story.
Well, this is the first world premiere we've done in our opera house. I'd done one earlier at the Music Hall in the first years of founding this company. And I was determined that this opera and this world premiere should be one that that paid tribute to and honored the history and of the experience, of the African-American experience. I thought that was very appropriate for a city like Detroit that has such a large African-American population. And I was particularly excited because there were so many talented people that wanted to come together, were very excited about this project. And, of course, the great star, Denise Graves, who is probably one of the leading singers in the world today, is singing the title role, and she's surrounded by an incredible cast. So I think it's, and I've found that that it is a wonderful way. You know, so many operas are based on history, and so, for example, opera by Verdi is one of them, called Nabucco, is about the Israelites in captivity. So for 100 years, people go to the opera house, and they feel the emotion of the Israelites captured by the Babylonians. Well, it's so exciting, and many of my African-American friends and leaders in this community express this. Imagine, our history is also worthy of being documented with the power of an art form that 50 years from now, whether it be in Geneva or whether it be in South America, they will go to the opera house and they will see on the stage, through this very powerful art form which we call opera, seen the history and the story and the emotions of a time in history that shouldn't be forgotten. It should be, it should just simply be revered as something that our people have come through. And that's really what opera can do, I think, in a very special way, not for just the present, but for a very long period of time.
Now, the world premiere of Margaret Garner is going to be at the Detroit Opera House on May 7th, and with performances through May 22nd. And it's also going to be, Cincinnati Opera is going to be presenting this as well in July, and the Opera Company of Philadelphia will present the work next February. It always struck me with some performances of plays, and to some extent here as well, this incredible effort, probably involving hundreds of people, am I correct?
Yes.
And it's going to have a run for 2 weeks.
Yes. Five performances.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah, right.
So,
opera is so expensive because, you know, you go to a musical theater piece, whatever it is, I think, for example, whatever you might see here, at most you have 30 people involved and perhaps an orchestra of 15 or 20. So 50 at the most. Here we have a chorus of 70. An orchestra of 75. You have 40 stagehands behind the scenes moving things around. You have, you know, dressers and things. So you often, and some operas are even bigger, like Aida, which we're doing in the following year, can be as much as 300 people involved. So the amount of participation by is so huge. And that's why you don't tour opera very easily, because it is so so incredibly expensive to move this many people and get them from one place to another.
Well, I know in Tosca that the settings, the staging, without before anybody even sung a note, got wonderful rounds of applause.
We had Rome astounded. On stage. That was for all the people that didn't go to Rome for the funeral. We wanted to make them feel like they had already gone. Last scene actually showed the Vatican in the background, as you recall.
Yeah. So this is May 7th, and can we expect Toni Morrison in town?
Toni will be there for opening night, and as a matter of fact, I just learned that Felicia Rashad is going to be there for opening night, so we're going to have some, you know, some wonderfully talented people both on stage and in the audience.
And the easiest way to get tickets?
Is just to call the box office, 237-SING. Is the easiest way for me to say it. It's 237-7464. And there are tickets available for each of the five performances.
Now, we hopefully have hundreds and hundreds, at least, people saying, Wow, I never thought about going to opera, but I just listened to Werby and David DiChiara, and I want to go. Is this a good first opera, you think, for people to go to?
I think it is, particularly because, first of all, it's in English. It's a very, very absorbing story, and the music is there's some wonderful music in it, and I think people will be very moved by it, and they will see what opera is about. I always find it very exciting when people try opera for the first time, and I always like to say, you know, give it a try.
Yeah. Well, I'll certainly be one of the participants. I hope many of the people listening will join me. One of the sources you can go to is margaretgarner.org, and also the opera theater itself, michiganopera.org. David DiChiara, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, I am pleased to be here and to speak to your wonderful audience.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
This is WRIF.com.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for a big money this year because the WRIF Fishing Championship Series is coming. The series consists of four tournaments this year: walleye, catfish, bass, and muskie. In each tournament, anglers compete for cash and prizes, and the team with the best average finish in the four tournament series will also win $1,500 cash, plus the title of 2005 WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champions. After each event, competitors get to kick back and party at Big Al Sports Bar for the awards and more chances to win prizes from the Riff. The first tournament kicks off on April 23rd at the Lake Erie Metro Park for the WRIF Walleye Championship. The teams start their boats at 6:30 a.m. and will weigh their catch at 4 p.m. 2 to 3 person teams compete for thousands in cash and prizes, but one team will finish the day holding the championship trophy. To sign up or to find out about a sponsorship, call 248-591-6841 today or go to WRIF.com to get a registration form. Become the WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Listening WRIF.com.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
Rip rocks.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like the Shark Club on Ford Road, just east of Canton Center Road in Canton. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
On the Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
2 for Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
Like what you hear on the Riff. riff, then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.